Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back! We have to go back! We have to go back! We have to go back!
We're gonna need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episode 7, Not in Portland. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have a question for my co-host. Would you knowingly take a job on the island? Because if they were upfront about the whole jungle of mystery thing, of course I would.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and having lived on Hawaii for a year, I will say definitively that I would only take a short-term contract job on the island because island life gets boring after a while.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm saying yes pretty much right away and without pretty much any strings.
You are listening to a Lost rewatch podcast. We're rewatching the ABC series Lost. It's streaming on like Hulu in America, and I believe Sky in the UK and all over the place. It was a show that was on for 6 seasons on ABC. We started at season 1, episode 1. We are up to season 3, episode 7, and we are here for everybody. If this is your first time enjoying Lost, if this is one of your rewatches enjoying Lost, we welcome you, and we split our podcast into parts for you. The first part will be called The Calm, and that will only involve things from this most recent rewatch. That means things we could talk about only up through season 3, episode 7, the character names we may or may not know, a certain last name we learn in this episode. We can now finally say super fun times because we've been doing it for 3 seasons and 7 episodes. The interview section will also not have any spoilers. Joanna, who are you talking to this week?
Oh my God, it's the long-awaited crossover event you've been dying to listen to. Mallory Rubin of Binge Mode fame, our pal, who we've hung out with at Con of Thrones, is here to talk about Dr. Juliet Burke, who is a favorite character of hers. So we're going to talk about Juliet in a spoiler-free way for a little bit. And then there's also just like a little nugget of conversation with Mallory where we talk about some spoilery stuff that you will hear in our Storm section. So Mallory Rubin's here.
That's right. It's a Storm section. If you look down your podcast device, you're going to see time codes for The Calm, The Interview, and The Storm. The Storm is where you do not want to go if you are worried about being spoiled about what happens in Lost beyond season 3, episode 7. Maybe you haven't seen it before and care about spoilers. We want to make room for you. You could hop off after the interview transitions into spoiler town. But that doesn't matter because right now, we're in Calm. We're all friends here. If you would like to support the podcast more than you already are by giving us a listen, you could go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and see the many tiers at which you can subscribe to get bonus content from us. At the very lowest tier, you get access to our Slack. You also get access to a podcast series that Joanna started doing during these quarantine times called Feels Like the First Time. Neil and I recently got subjected to Pride and Prejudice by Joe Wright.
We volunteered, so I would say.
Thank you, Neil.
We volunteered.
We volunteered to be subject to the rigors of the Feels Like the First Time format, is the way
that's
describe
right.
It.
So if you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, you could listen to Feel Like the First Time, including episodes with me and Neil. When we start our first episode, we think we're watching a different movie, but we end up with Pride and Prejudice, which is only why I say subjected to. If you want to get all these in-jokes, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, lowest possible level, you get not only Neil and I's Feels Like the First Time, but all of Kristen Rousseau's Feels Like the First Time, Future Feels Like the First Time, and there are other levels where you could watch along movies with us in our Slack, You can get bonus podcasts every week. Tons of stuff. Patreon.com/Storm of Spoilers. That's it for me this week. Joanna, how can people get in contact with the show besides Patreon?
Oh, you can go find us on Twitter at Storm Podcast. You can go to stormpodcast.com and find out about like our schedule, when we're recording things, when we're doing bonus stuff. All of that is over there. It's a good time. Or you can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. We've got a couple fun emails for the Storm section this week. And you can also leave us a review. We always appreciate that. I've got two reviews I'm going to read really quickly because I don't know if you could tell, but Dave has decided we're going to tighten it up for this episode. So the first review was 3 stars, mixed bag. And it says, I like the rewatch and the short and long-term analysis of the show, but the pretentious, how could we rewrite the show to fit with our 2019-2020 left-wing sensibilities, weaved throughout is beyond tiresome only a few episodes in. I have a bad news for that person. That's it. That's the podcast.
That's the premise of the show.
The podcast is, what do we think about Lost in the year of our Lord 2020? So that bag is only going to get more mixed for you as you go on. All right. This other review comes from someone named Michael, 5 stars, and the title of the review is, fun fact, Michael does appear in this review. I followed this pod from the Storm of Spoilers days and listened to some of their other pods, so I was thrilled when they decided to cover Lost, one of my favorite shows. It's a shame podcasting wasn't huge when Lost was on the air. I enjoyed this pod so much that I had to re-download the iTunes app to write this review. I waited until I finally caught up before I posted one. This pod does a great job of balancing non-spoilers and spoilers, much like the balance of dark and light. Their rapport puts a good amount of humor into the episodes. They also do a great job of equal opportunity gazing to a respectable level. The one gripe I have is that a lot of the spoilers get bleeped out of the column in the interviews, and I'm dying to know what they were saying as someone who has completed the show. The bleeps rob us of some insight the way Desmond's buttons rob us of a hunk. But besides that, keep up the great work. Whenever Joanna brings up the Tumblr, it makes me miss my barely popular Lost blog. Keep up the great work, Michael. So thanks, Michael. Sorry, mixed bad guy. And those are our reviews. Neil?
Yes?
What happened on Lost this week?
Well, this week on Lost, we are, as you know, going somewhere that's not quite in Portland. Not in Portland is the episode title, and it was directed by Stephen Williams, our friend and yours, written by Carlton Cuse and Jeff Pinkner. It has a runtime of 44 minutes, and it aired on February 7th, 2007. That is, if you're doing the math, following a 91-day break for the Lost audience. That sounds terrible, and it was. It takes place on day 73 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn a little bit about how Juliet ended up on the island. It's a simple story that involves solving her sister's infertility, taking a job interview with a guy whose eyes really do just look like that naturally, and getting her ex-husband hit by a bus. Next thing she knows, she's headed for somewhere that's not quite in Portland. Back at Hydra Island General Hospital, Jack and Juliet have a standoff as Jack's plan to help Kate and Sawyer escape gets underway. It looks like Juliet isn't buying Jack's ruse, which puts everyone in quite a pickle, but only until Ben wakes up for some mid-surgery manipulation. Next thing Juliet knows, she's headed out into the jungle. Speaking of which, elsewhere on Hydra Island, after kicking Danny's ass a little bit, Sawyer and Kate vacate Cage Town and head out into the jungle. As they make their escape, they bump into Alex, who recruits them for a mission that involves punching Rob McElhenney in the face and saving Carl from what appears to be some kind of brainwash torture chamber. The episode ends with Juliet shooting Danny, Kate telling the story, everybody crying, Jack fixing Ben, and the revelation that Ben has promised to let Juliet go home. It is very many emotions. Fun fact, Tom had a rough day. Shout out to Tom. Also, shout out to J.J. Abrams, who was originally supposed to direct this episode, but did not, paving the way for Stephen Williams to direct a really good episode, as we're going to discuss. Slightly more fun fact, the bus that hits Juliet's ex-husband, whose name I've already forgotten. That's how much that guy sucked.
Dr. Asshole Burke. Yeah. Aging Dr. Asshole Burke.
Dr. whatever his name is. The bus that hits him has an ad for Apollo candy bars, which we know from the pantry in the hatch. This week's column question, have either of you been to Portland? Joanna, have you ever been to Portland?
I have been to Portland.
All right. I've never been personally, but it's very high on my list of places to visit and maybe even move to eventually.
Oh my God. Are you going to move to Portland?
No, I don't know.
I love Portland. Portland's great. I think you would love it in Portland. I'm a big fan of Portland. They've got great public transportation, fantastic bookstores, beautiful trees. I've been told by your friend and mine, Diana, the producer of this podcast, that I am never allowed to visit Ashland, Oregon, because she is convinced if I go to Ashland, Oregon, I will never return. So...
fair enough.
That apparently is like has everything that I could ever want.
Dave,
plus the Shakespeare Festival. Dave, yes.
Dave, do you have any cities in Oregon that you're banned from visiting because you might move there forever?
I've never been to Oregon, but it is, I think, one of the places that if we were to move out of Denver, Job was talked about maybe going to like Portland. And I, you know, every state has its challenges. Like here in Denver, we've got Boulder with like its hippies, but like, you know, our governor used to be a KKK member. From what I understand of the Pacific Northwest, you guys he's got a lot of white guys making compounds with guns up there, so I'm a little nervous. But you know, if they are doing little island trips out of there, then I guess I'd rather be closer to the island and farther away from the island.
Yeah,
Portland.
Yeah, let's do it.
Portland? Is that what we've all decided? Everyone's
I think we're going to, what we've decided is that we're going to open a podcast compound in Ashland, right. Oregon. Mm-hmm, I think that's sort of where we landed.
Yeah, that I mean, just like Google image search Ashland, Oregon. And
I
mean, tell
I don't
me
even
don't
want to. I'm too scared.
Tell me you don't want to live there.
It'll be excellent. I will be in charge of our, brewing and growing our intoxicants. That'll be my
don't tell
contribution
Dave
to the commune.
That it's a cult.
Yeah.
Definitely not a cult, but we should maybe go there.
Treat me like that the undercover cop that Locke found. Just if you just don't shoot me in the woods. All right.
Fair enough.
We're back into Good Lost in season 3. I've been saying it the past couple of episodes that maybe I've been appearing a little mad at Lost for getting a little boring. We had, you know, some chemistry between Kate and Sawyer that we had to ruin with our facts about television production. But we're finally to Not in Portland, which has some of my favorite stuff in it, specifically... Room 23, I really dig, because if you know what I like about Lost, it's so the crazy mystery chef that makes no sense. And also surprisingly on the island, it's not that I don't like Juliet's backstory, I really do, but on the island, what surprised me during this rewatch is sort of Sawyer's pivot, where before he went in the cage, I think we were dealing with a Sawyer that was very driven by like revenge and being selfish, and it appears like his experience in the cage has softened him. I think it's most evident not only by like helping Kate, because obviously he loves Kate and has admitted that now, but when they come across Alex and she's like, you need to help me find my boyfriend, and he's like, it's not Carl, is it? She's like, yeah. And then that's all she has to say for Sawyer to come around and yank Carl out of room 23. So in the weird process we've been tracking of Sawyer getting better and Jack getting worse, I think this episode kind of tracks with it. Jack panics, which isn't a great look for giving up all of your plots like right at the top of the episode, being like, Julia told me to kill him and now I, you know, slit the thing and now she can't stitch him up and I'm Jack, I know what's happening. But I do think it also ties in well with, you know, Kate telling him the story at the end and that sort of alleviating this panic. So if we're balancing Sawyer and Jack on the inverse slopes of being better dudes, I think we got like a plus two on the Sawyer side and a plus zero on the Jack side.
Sawyer is like in that context you just put him of like, it's not Carl, is it? That reminds me of like a breed of dad that I've only discovered through Milo of TikTok, which is a dad reluctant to get a pet but then falls in love with the pet more than anyone else in the family does.
Right.
Like grumpy, reluctantly gooey dad. That's Sawyer.
So no, like, Carl.
He's Carl's reluctantly gooey savior.
Yeah, so we get Carl in a room that is doing some crazy brainwashing stuff on him. What can I tell you people who are watching this for the first time about what we saw on that screen? We saw a U.S. coin from 1921 with the words superimposed over it, "Everything changes." The reason that's important is the in 1956 the old slogan "E pluribus unum" became "In God We Trust." We see God loves you as he loved Jacob. We are the causes of our own suffering, and many close-ups of dolls, fish, and women's eyes, and then some picnic tables, and then there's a voice playing backwards. It's all a bunch of mysteries.
Yeah,
that's all I can say. Right?
What does the backwards voice say?
The backwards voice says, "Only fools are enslaved by time and space."
And what is Rob McElhenney reading when we come upon him?
Oh, it seems like that would be something we would share, say, for the book club corner at the end of the episode.
Okay.
Are these two things related? Find out at 10.
What a fun, sexy, creepy time for everyone in that room.
For Carl, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I guess I understand what they might be trying to accomplish with Carl, some sort of behavioral readjustment on like a subconscious level. But I have some questions, obviously.
His brain just needs a little wash, a little rinse, a little rinse
sure,
of the brain.
Right, the last time we saw Carl was he was having trouble in Cage Town, and then tried to escape.
I guess
he's trying to stage a coup in Cage Town.
That's right.
In terms of like things we learn about the others, if we take all the very good narrative stuff and like strip it away, fertility problems, don't have a surgeon obviously as part of them. And then we've sort of explored throughout season two this idea that they're separating people into good and bad and asking like for judgment. And so really what Room 23 is like kind of super insidious about is now it's actually putting God, like the judgment of God, on the table, I think. So like, it's creepy if there's a whole bunch of people who are judging if you're good or bad based on like some sort of island attunement. But it's especially creepy if those people are zealots. I think it's creepier.
Yeah, and I guess it's curious that we get some more like of the religious like iconography and some of those themes start to creep in. But also the flashback is about sort of the science-y reasons why Juliet has, you know, is being looked at by this company that wants to take her to Portland. So
not
it's
quite Portland.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. I think that's an interesting like balance. Like the show's almost doing the man of science, man of faith thing with the others a little bit. Because I do remember very vividly being very fascinated, less fascinated with what's going on with Carl in Room 23 and more fascinating with like, wait, why do they need Juliet again for the eye? Like, really now understanding a little bit more about her background, like trying to understand what the island needed from her, which I think is a really fun thing to kind of track for every character we meet, really.
Well, and right. And this idea that like people can be drafted to the island.
Yeah, exactly.
As full blown adultsies, you know what I mean?
Like, not everybody had to come here via plane crash.
Right. And not everyone was raised here.
Exactly.
So like, sometimes you just get drafted to being a jungle creep. So,
yeah, which is fascinating, like, world-opening stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we also, we have Ethan, who's there, who makes sense, because we saw Ethan working with Claire, so if you're going to have an other that's concerned with fertility, it makes sense that he would eventually have been in contact with Juliet.
It's creepy that he's there in that first scene, though. Where she's going to dose her sister. What's Ethan doing there?
Yes. So, well, I mean, Ethan being creeping around is creepy.
Creeping.
Yeah.
He's hallway creeping. He doesn't have a jungle, like Miami is not really jungly. It's like more palm tree, right? So he's like, he's hallway creeping instead of jungle creeping.
Fine. Got it.
Yep. His presence just being there for the last scene between him, Dr. Albert, and Juliet makes that scene feel menacing. Like, to be fair, Juliet is correct in that she said she wanted her husband to get hit by a bus, and then he got hit by a bus, and then eyeliner shows up again and probes her. But it doesn't read as creepy until you realize that, like, Ethan's there, and, like, that's the guy that, you know, like, broke all of Steve Scott's bones in his hand, came out of the ocean.
He came out of the ocean.
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot about Dr. Albert just yet, but we know Ethan.
I mean, I don't know how Dr. Albert got Juliet to the island, but I'm pretty sure Ethan just, like, swam from Miami to wherever the island is. And then when he got there, he just came up out of the ocean.
And killed Scott or Steve or whoever.
That Mapother energy.
Yep. Remember when he, like, strung Charlie up? Oh,
I mean, Ethan. Yeah, not great track record.
He keeps coming back. We couldn't get Mr. Echo to stick around for two seasons, but here's Ethan again in season three. Welcome back. I think the Juliet stuff's really effective. The reveal is really effective. I think this episode is really great at sprinkling in more status quo changes of our understanding of the others. I think it's the first episode where, because Ben is in such a vulnerable position, I actually believe the infighting of the others is 100% infighting and not necessarily somebody having an agenda that they need, like, Jack to see, or Pickett being a little too into his wife. Speaking of Joanna, Juliet gets to shoot Pickett this episode.
Oh my God, what a fucking blessed day. I talked to our guest Mallory Rubin about this at length, so we don't need to go into it that much. But, like, if you weren't already on Team Juliet, her relieving all of us from more Pickett surely got you excited. Also, Alex coming through with a slingshot. Like, it's a good, it was a good episode for some scrappy ladies, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think Alex has always been great at the slingshot. This is, like, her second slingshot savior, but here we learn that she has made a Hydra hidey hole where apparently she's been hanging out after little excursions into the compound, and then also, you know, has a boat that eventually Sawyer and Kate get to use to take an unconscious Carl back to the island, concluding the first episode, I think, where we have not been on the main island at all.
Wait, I think it's
second episode?
Well, we got a lot. Didn't last week? Was it last week or the week before that we buried Mr. Echo? Well, like, that was the last time we really saw anything on the
island. I guess Tale of Two Cities, because Tale of Two Cities, like, we get the, you know, the Otherton. Wasn't the whole thing about, like, Tale of Two Cities where I was like, what are the two cities? And everyone was like, it's the beach village. And I'm like, well, the point is we weren't on the beach in this episode at all. You're in LA and you're in Otherton. For the suburbia stuff.
So the two cities are what? The two islands?
No, the two cities are, I think it's supposed to be the Otherton and the beach town. It just doesn't really align with what's in the episode. Can I say really quickly something about Alex's boat?
Yes.
This boat, this type of boat, is technically called an outrigger because it has, like, a counterbalance thing on the canoe part of it, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
That is a word I learned from Lost. So this is an outrigger.
The outrigger. Surely we'll never talk about that again because Joanna brought up the outrigger.
The boat. Whatever.
Sorry.
The boat doesn't burst into flames between this week and the next. So.
I was going to say something and have to beat myself. Okay, looking up, this is actually, according to Lostpedia, this is the first episode that does not feature any scenes on the main island. The only other such episode is beep, so don't worry about it. Cool. Neil,
yes.
What do we think about Juliet's pregnancy breakthrough this episode?
Well, I think that's part of what makes the flashback so interesting. And I think that, you know, I don't know if this is a trend that we can track very easily, but like the stronger the flashback, obviously the better the episode because it's a huge chunk of it. And I think that, you know, even though we get a little bit more mystery with like Room 23 and like what's going on there, I think that the fact that Juliet is on the island is maybe the, you know, like, and her expertise, you know, it's building the mystery of why was Ethan interested in Claire, which I think is great because they're building on a mystery that we kind of forgotten about for a little while. You know, the pregnancy, the vaccine, you know, ever since Aaron was born, that sort of faded into the background. And it's great to have that back. And I think Juliet's a really good sort of vehicle with that. I think I love the scenes with her and her sister. Those two actresses do great work, you know, in very little amount of time. So, yeah, no, I'm interested to see what kind of science she's up to.
Yeah. Joanna, I have a question for you that you know the answer of because you've seen the rest of the series, but pretend you've just seen Not in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like, you know, in this episode, Jack makes another mistake. He makes an intentional mistake, but then he also, you know, clips an artery. And then in flashbacks, we've seen Jack be a miraculous spinal surgeon who fixed his future wife's legs when it wasn't supposed to be possible. Here we see Juliet basically make a miracle off island, but on island, it appears she's struggling. Is that a purposeful correlation? Does the island sort of like anti-medicine?
The island anti-medicine. No, I don't know that I want to definitively say that the island is anti-medicine. I don't think the island is like an anti-vaxxer. I don't think the island would say like, don't wear your mask during COVID. But I will say that the island magic like works in mysterious ways. And like often when things go awry, that's because the island is trying to push it one direction or another. So like, the island cured Rose's cancer and it made John walk again and stuff like that. So the island is doing its own medical miracles. And so if something goes awry, probably the island has a reason for it.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't necessarily trying to say like anti-medicine, like it doesn't believe in vaccines. But if we're dealing with a show that is constantly putting faith up against science, it seems interesting that our most talented scientists are in the world of science, do faith-based miracles, and then in the world of faith, keep having trouble replicating science-based facts. It seems like that's the show at least bringing that dichotomy back to the forefront again, where it's like, even if you take somebody who's super smart in their field, who should know exactly what's going on, you throw them on this mystery island, and suddenly their life falls apart. They're trapped. They're in a weird power struggle. They're apparently grinding up their own beef to make hamburgers and not working on any pregnant women at all. It just seems like the island wants your faith and is not here for your science. If you try to science it up, it's going to give you an exploding button room and you're going to... It's you're gonna doom a generation to being
maybe.
Inside.
I mean, I guess we still don't know enough about Juliet on the island to know what she's been doing when she hasn't been like been part of the Jack. Let's get Jack to operate on Ben plot. Like, I don't know what her schedule looks like, so she might still be doing some science elsewhere.
Monday book club, Tuesday read book, Wednesday second book club.
Wednesday convince Jack to do surgery. Thursday. I have 3 appointments with pregnant women that we haven't seen on the island.
Friday, check on that kid who I keep letting him drag a muddy teddy bear wherever he wants to go. Should probably clean that teddy bear.
Yeah, I do want to know who's involved in the planning for that stuff, though. But it seems like that seems like a very Tom job. Tom seems kind of like he might be into the theater a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just a nice guy who loves crafting costumes.
A flair for the dramatic.
A flair for the dramatic, yes.
Mm-hmm. Does have a flair for the dramatic. Even though, you know, he manages to keep a level head with all the chaos going on. But you're right that Tom has a real bad week.
Yeah, yeah, he's having a tough one.
Okay. Is there anything we need to talk about specifically around, I guess, Kate and Sawyer's escape before we hop to our corners? since I'm told the wonderful death of Pickett is covered in our interview.
I mean, like, I don't know that I want to talk about their escape. But yeah, our guest Mallory Rubin goes into great detail about some of that stuff in a really fascinating way and how it reveals larger themes of the show. But I want to talk about Robin Wiegert really quickly, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys, you have two fellas, Deadwood, or anyone listening have seen Robin Wiegert do other stuff. She's incredible in Deadwood, but a number of other things. And she's just like one of those actors where whenever she shows up, I mean, I think she's on this season of The Politician, and I would not recommend that because that show is garbage town. But like, other than that, when Robert Wiegert shows up, you're going to have a good time. Yeah. She's going to be great. There was just a time when she was just on everything. Like, she was great on Sons of Anarchy. Like, she would just show up because they were like, oh, do we need, like, someone who rules? Let's get Robin Wiegert. So, yeah, I just want to shout her out and how excited I was to see her here.
Rachel, you're going to have a baby.
Yeah.
Wait, assuming, you know, assuming everything went fine for Juliet between when we left off with her and when we caught up with her on the island.
Yeah, and I mean, like, did Juliet leave her miraculously pregnant sister?
Yeah.
Well, she says she's been on the island for, what, 3 years, 2 months, and 28 days. So either that baby's a toddler or something really bad happened.
Yeah, she also, interestingly, that somebody did the math on it, and it's September 5th, 2001, which is like, I'm glad that they have a line to the mainland still, because that would be weird to have stopped knowing what's going on in the world like that week.
Yeah, it's all September 5th, 2001.
It's September 5th, 2001, so it's like a week later, like everything was totally different in the world. It was crazy. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good thing that they know about the Red Sox, so I assume Juliet knows about 9/11.
Yeah, somebody got a VHS of 9/11 over there.
Dark.
Well, dark, but I mean, history.
Dark, but also true. Yeah.
I watched that shit on TV. That was fucking, ugh. Talk about TV moments of fun. 9/11. So, Joanna, pivoting off of 9/11. No, I'm kidding. Are we good for ready to go to the corners?
Let's do it.
All right. Neil, we've got some Giacchino Corner. He brings the goods this week.
We did. There's a theme there toward the end called Here Today, Gone to Maui.
Hey!
Wow.
Yeah, that's the man I remember.
Exceptional stuff. And it includes the life and death theme, which we were talking about. I wrote in the notes the life and death theme, aka the Soul Crusher. You get a little bit of it there at the end with Kate, and as she's telling the story, that's the score that you're hearing. And I love that because it really enhances sort of the moment that Kate and Sawyer are kind of experiencing there as she's having this really emotional connection with Jack over the radio. It just, yeah, gets me every time. But good name this week. Here Today, Gone to Maui.
He's back. He's back, yep, for his corner.
Yeah. Okay. Now I know. Okay. Because you were like, it involves the love and loss theme. Is that what it is?
Life and death.
Life and death theme. Right. Yeah. you said that. I had no idea what that was, but I do know that when we were watching this episode and that scene was happening and season one music came in, I started crying. So now I know what you were talking about.
That's the one. So it's, yeah, and the life and death composition is like, it's like that couple of beats, piano beats that you hear in a bunch of different stuff in the Lost soundtrack.
It's in the Raft theme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, ooh, good stuff, Giacchino. I'm glad it's good to have you back, man. Season two was rough. Yeah,
here today, gone to Maui. Our jungle of mystery moment goes to all of Room 23. What the fuck was happening in there? We have no idea. Trying to explain it, you heard me do earlier.
Yeah, and folks really went crazy for that when this aired. I remember like it was the "What does everything mean?" trying to, you know. Who is that character that Tom Hanks played with the hair that looked like a bird? And he was like Angels and Demons. What was that guy's name? Robert
Langdon?
Langdon? Yeah.
Yeah, that was the weird way to get to Robert Langdon.
Yeah, I know.
His hair looked like a bird.
Well, yeah, kind of. It's like the bird hair. Nicolas Cage did that kind
of
hair.
The ending of Cloud Atlas. I mean, because that's the only thing I could think about.
He had really bad hair. I also went to Cloud Atlas because Dave and I were talking about it earlier today. But like, yeah, he had really bad
hair. Da Vinci
hair.
Code. That's what I'm looking for.
I never thought that it looked like a bird, but sure.
But yeah, the Room 23 turned Lost fans into like the Da Vinci Code guy for a week. It was great.
Oh, yeah. And not necessarily without purpose, as we'll visit in our official podcast check-in. But we're not there yet. The Boone Carlyle Memorial Falling Down Award. We got three here. Neil, explain to me what you've done.
This is sort of a trifecta of things. So first we have Edmund, who the cause of his falling down is bus. Mm-hmm. Then we have Danny. Yeah.
Can I say really quickly? Mm-hmm. We talked about Juliet Burke and the meaning of her name last week, and how like Burke is the name of it's Edmund Burke is the name of a philosopher, and that's mm-hmm. her shitty ex-husband's name.
Yes.
And one last thing really quickly, he's played by Zelshko Ivanek, who is another tremendous character actor who you might remember from season one of Damages or another number of other things. So they got Robin Wiegert and Ivanek in this episode. Wow. Yeah, Lost.
Just crushing it.
All right.
So Edmund Burke falls down via bus. Danny also falls down via gunshot. And both of these men fall down via Juliet. She's the... I guess it depends on how much you believe in the karma of the bus thing, or like how much you believe that that is connected at this point. But yeah, Juliet is sort of, she knocks them both down.
Yeah, it's hard to see coincidence in the montage of a television show that's written and has magic in it. So I would say yes, both by Juliet. Juliet deals out two falling down awards. The Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes to Dr. Alpert, who, when Juliet says, my husband just got hit by a bus, and all right, that's what I said to you earlier, says, I don't even remember you saying that.
Yeah, sure you don't.
Just sure, like some mild gaslighting.
I don't wear eyeliner. That's something else he said. We should say really quickly, Nestor Carbonell, who is like, you will see him again on Lost, it's not a spoiler to say. A lot of people call him Guyliner. That's like a thing that this character is called. Poor Nestor Carbonell has had to prove many times that he is not wearing eyeliner at all times. He just looks like that. But you can call him Guyliner. It's fine. It's not disrespectful. It's fine. Call him Guyliner. I did for years. So,
The Jungle of Kistery. Joanna, let's go back last week. Who gets to kiss each other in our shipping section?
Well, this is fun because last week we had a nomination that was Alex and her dead boyfriend, and that got very few votes, only 12% of the votes. And maybe that's because most people watching knew that Carl wasn't dead.
Yay!
I thought he was dead. Yay, Carl's alive. So Alex and her dead boyfriend, 12% of the vote. The Masked Doctors, so that's Julia and Jack, I suppose.
Yeah, maybe 16, we're not ready for that one yet.
16% of the vote. Anyone watching plus stripper cop Nathan Fillion, 29% of the vote, sorry.
If it was stripper firefighter, I would have won.
But clear winner, without question, Kate and Juliet, 41% of the vote. I'm on the, I mean, like, I was all on the Kate and Ana Lucia ship, so I'm happy to climb aboard the Kate and Juliet. Ship.
What would their, like, ship, because, you know, isn't there ship names for everybody, right? There's Jate. Which is Jack and Kate, right?
Yeah, so it can't be Jate again. So it would have to be like Cooliet.
Ooh.
Cooliet. All right.
Can you do something with their last name like Boston?
Good. Boston.
But I think Cooliet is better.
Cooliet.
Yep. All right. Who are we putting this week on our poll at Storm Podcast on Twitter?
All right. So this comes from some of our Patreon subscribers who would do the live watch with us. They put some nominees in while we were doing the live watch. So round two, Carl and Alex are back. This time Carl is alive. That was submitted by our listener Simon. So Carl and Alex.
Yay, Carl.
Yeah, they earned it.
Listener Shruti, who's watching for the first time, has put Russo and Ben in there because she is reeling from the information that Alex appears to be Ben's daughter, which means that at some point Ben and Russo had a thing. Crazy.
Mystery jungle smooch.
Jeff has submitted Dr. Asshole Burke. I edited that. It's Dr. Edmund Burke and the bus that came in from Jeff. So the kiss of death. But then we have another kiss of death from Heather that's Pickett and the Bullet. So our falling
Pickett
down
and the Bullet sounds like a man and a dog who solve crimes in like Maine.
It's so much more disappointing in reality.
just as she did our
and
falling
dog
out award, Juliet is dominating our history moment here. So is it the bus that Juliet had hit her shitty ex-husband, or is it the bullet that she used to kill Pickett with? Let's find out.
Excellent. We'll be tweeting that poll and you could vote and then tune in next week for the results. Our book club, as Joanna pointed out, is A Brief History of Time. Wonder what that could mean. And why is like a normal henchman just reading it? That seems like some deep henchman reading.
Hmm.
Dun, 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 dun. Leading question. Where's Libby? It's a corner where we remember that Libby was a character who is weaving in and out of everybody's flashbacks and connects everybody. Where was Libby this week, Neil?
Libby was driving the bus.
Yeah.
That is the best place for Libby to have popped up.
Libby's just accelerating right along the curb, waiting for him to step out.
So what happened was that meeting with Dr. Alpert and our man, Ethan, Mapther Energy, called up Libby and were like, we got a job. And she's like, you son of a bitch, I'm in. And they're like, we just need you to hit a guy with a bus. And she's like, oh, that's an easy one. Last time I had to give away a boat.
Yeah.
So.
You know, I just looked up Libby's last name because I had forgotten it. Do you guys remember what her last name is?
Elizabeth.
Nope.
It's Smith. But I was just thinking, like, because they could call, like, she's Dr. Smith. This is Dr. Alpert. We need you to help us get Dr. Burke to come with us.
Excellent.
Need you to get the doctor bus.
Take out Dr. Asshole Burke for us. Thanks so much.
I mean, given the way he turned around and was standing there not paying attention, it's surprising that he didn't get hit by a bus earlier in life. He does not seem to have much spatial awareness.
He has one of the best throwaway lines at the top of that scene. Let me see if I could find it real quick here, because here we go. This is Ed. He's talking on the phone and we cut in before Julie.
Oh, yes.
And what he says is, because you're insufferable and you're mean. Well, you asked me for the truth, Mom, and that's the truth. And it's just like, oh, fuck this guy. I hope he gets hit by a bus.
Works, I mean, so some people's moms are insufferable and mean, but it's still a great line.
Yeah, it's a good line. Good job, Carlton. All right, the official podcast check-in. There was...
Did you say good job, Carlton, because it would be Dad if it were Damon? Lost. No. Not just for daddy issues anymore.
I said good job, Carlton, because he wrote the episode, but yes. all right. The official podcast check-in. They ran an official podcast where Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would answer your questions. It ran concurrently with the episode. We've been doing little snippets here. Sometimes they like let people know things that I would consider secrets, but that's okay. They decided this is when you get to know them. So here we go. Neil is going to read the part of Damon Lindelof, and I'm going to read the part of Carlton Cuse.
All right. I think those glasses...
Never mind. I put this as a storm topic, but I guess Damon and Carlton are talking about it here. Okay.
I think those glasses, I credit to Stephen Williams, who's the director of this episode.
Yeah.
Basically, every once in a while, as producers, we get back dailies or see a show, and we'll see something that in it and have no idea that it was coming. And that is, you know, pun intended, part of Steven's unique vision. I don't know if those glass, what those glasses are all about, but I guess when you're watching that screen through them, it's even trippier than normal. What was going on in that screen? It feels like there's a lot of little Easter eggs buried there.
There is. There's a pretty good Easter egg. You know, there's an anagram in episode 7 that has an important clue about something that will...
I'm sure everybody's figured out by now. It's Middelos.
Middelos.
You know.
Lost time. And I would think that...
As in...
Be important.
As in, you lost time between the hours of 10 and 11 p.m. watching the show last week.
And scene. They're putting anagrams in the show.
Okay. They're putting books
in the show.
So we should say Middelos, which is the company that Dr. Alpert works for, is an anagram of lost time.
Correct. All right. One of those words is the name of the show.
Yeah.
And Mac from Always Sunny was reading
The Brief History of Time.
Yes. By Stephen Hawking.
Mm. Interesting.
And then that thing on the thing said,
only fools are enslaved by time and space.
Yeah.
Correct.
So there's a lot of different time-related messages going on here.
Interesting.
There's time and God both came through real hard this episode.
I mean, does this feel like the first time that we're getting some time stuff?
This feels like the first time the creators are leaning into it.
Yeah. So like we've explored some religious iconography and themes and ideas. I don't know if we've quite
there was that time that Saeed sort of jokingly said like, or what time the broadcast would be coming from. But it wasn't like the show doubled back on that. So this is the first time where the show keeps throwing time at you, I think.
It's just interesting. It's a thing to note for later.
Thing to
know. Time is almost dead. All right. Should we hear from the great Mallory Rubin?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. We are thrilled to have on the podcast a long requested crossover event, I think. The Ringer editor in chief Mallory Rubin is here. Hello, Mallory.
Oh my God. Joanna. What an honor. What a privilege to be here with you at last. I'm overjoyed. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
A true thrill. So the reason that you're here is because, I mean, I would take any reason to have you here, obviously. But a reason why you are specifically here today to talk about this episode is because I happen to know that as much as you remember Lost these many years later, you are a fan of Sawyer and of Dr. Juliet Burke.
Yes.
And so we are here to talk about Dr. Juliet Burke. Those, I mean, like the Sawyer thing, I know because you and I have identical taste in TV character men.
Yes. Right? Any bearded man, basically, who's ever appeared in a fantasy story, I think we'll find at the family compound we've built in our minds.
but I heard through the grapevine that you were also a fan of Juliet. And so I wanted to have you here to talk about the great Juliet. This is her first sort of solo episode, not in Portland. We get some of her backstory. We find out the weird, unusual properties of her hair, among other things. why it's curly off island and straight on island, I could never tell you, but that is the fact of her hair. So I wanted to ask you, as much as you could, in a spoiler-free way, granted that like a lot of our listeners have only watched up to this episode, what is it about Juliet? I know it's tough, but what is it about Juliet that you like so much?
Okay, I'm going to try really hard not to breach the spoiler etiquette, and if I do, just pull me back. Pull me back. Lost is one of my gateway fantasy shows. You know, it's one of the experiences that got me thinking about stories with the level of detail that we and many of our pals and fellow creators, you know, apply to Game of Thrones and other things nowadays. I did not watch it all as it was airing. I caught up heading into the final season. And so Juliet's arc, and obviously this would be true for any other arc, but it was a concentrated thing for me, right? Which I think is just worth noting because part of Lost, I think, plays out differently if you're watching it in real time, right? So I never had that, at least outside of the final season, which I did watch in real time. And fun fact, it was my first podcast experience back when I was at Sports Illustrated. Yeah. Stuart Mandel, great college football writer, had a college football podcast called The Mandel Initiative, a Dharma Initiative nod, obviously. And we would just smuggle in 10 to 15 minutes of Lost talk during the final season at the end of every episode. But, you know, I would soak up every word of the Doc Jensen recaps, and I just loved trying to parse the lore. If I saw a book in a scene, you know, I had the copy of Our Mutual Friend that I have on my bookshelf to this day. I got that because of Lost, you know. On and on the list goes. So yeah. I say that all to say, one, I love Lost. Two, Juliet, Sawyer, others, a foundational part of what made me fall in love with Lost in this very concentrated experience as I was binging it heading into the final season. And three, to acknowledge up front that it has been a very long time since I've seen Lost in full. And I think one of the things that's cool about that, actually, is that I've realized while getting ready for this conversation with you today that I was so excited about, that Juliet is one of the characters that I don't think that matters for. When I think back on Juliet and why I fell in love with her character and her arc, it's, I mean, of course, everything on Lost is in some way connected to the larger lore and mythology, but I don't necessarily need to remember every single plot mechanic to remember why I was invested in that 10 years ago. It's about how I felt about her. And, you know, it makes me think of, I feel like I bring up this line all the time, but it makes me think of the Halt and Catch Fire Joe line about, you know, it was never about where we were going. It was always about how it felt. And that is obviously broadly not true for Lost, and is, of course, deeply embedded in the legacy of how it is now processed and perceived. But I think that Juliet is a really remarkable creation because she is two things can be true at once for her. You know, she is deeply embedded in the mythology, and again, I'm dancing around like saying anything spoilery here about, you know, her arc and how it concludes and anything happening in, you know, later seasons. But as connected as she is, as embedded as she is in the magic of the island and the show, she is just a fascinating human being, you know, a fascinating character to explore the ideas of choice, you know, free will versus destiny and how that plays out in the show. Love stories on the show, you know, the interpersonal relationships that blossom between her and other characters were never straightforward, never reductive, and I always really appreciated that. You know, she's a brilliant doctor, a brilliant woman. Like, the fact that she is beautiful was never the point. She has this moral complexity in terms of her allegiances and her alliances. She allows a lot of the way we understand the island, the recruitment, obviously that's a thing to talk about with not in Portland, to open up for us. And the idea that despite how often, you know, black and white, good and evil, here are two stones that reflect this idea come into play in the show. Sometimes it's not just about which camp you're in the moment. It's about what you're trying to pursue, who you're trying to protect, the way that you change along the way, and the way that the change that you're experiencing can also change other people. And I just love that about her still to this day.
Yeah, I think that's something that I love about Juliet, and a lot of it is Elizabeth Mitchell's performance. Like, she comes on the scene and she's immediately enigmatic to us, and then that never fully goes away. Mm-hmm. I never feel like I fully understand. I've brought this up a couple times, and so forgive me to our listeners for me repeating it again, but like, in our very first season, one of our guests, Jenny Owen Youngs, described Juliet Burke as a sexy velociraptor, and I was just really into that description of her, because I just feel like she's always like, the wheels are always turning in her head, and she's always making choices on the fly, and you don't necessarily know which way she's going to go, because... Right. As you say, she defies the boxes that we might put some other characters in.
Yes, absolutely, which I always appreciate.
Something that I told you before we started recording that I wanted to talk about a little bit is this idea of like how to introduce characters midway through a season, several seasons of a television show. And you have freely admitted that your memory of Lost isn't perfect, so I'm not going to like grill you on details or anything like that. But a working theory that I have is, you know, like a few episodes into season two, they introduce the character of Ana Lucia, played by Michelle Rodriguez.
Sure.
They do what they feel like they you know, make sense to them to make her sort of a very important central figure on the show, even though she's a season two character. And it just doesn't really ever stick for audiences. Right. And then, you know, by end of season two, she's gone. And so I sometimes look at Juliet, or I've been looking at Juliet this go around as sort of like them looking, because what's interesting about season two of Lost is that the characters that they introduced as temporary characters, Desmond and Ben Linus, wound up being the characters that stuck around. Like those right. two actors were only hired to be on the show on a temporary basis, and they stick around because they are just like incredibly good sticky characters. And the people that they laid careful track for did not wind up surviving out of season two and early season three.
Right.
So then I feel like if I'm a writer and that's happened to me in season two, I'm going to be really careful about how I introduce this new character here in season three.
Mm-hmm.
And for our first time watchers, they seem to have responded really well to Juliet. The mm-hmm. same, you know, and I love Juliet, and I'm excited to see that plan is working on them. You meet her; she's like one of the bad guys, but she's a little nicer than your average bad guy. But it's also like, but are they the bad guys? And then in right. you know, seven episodes in, we get her POV. Mm-hmm. So what work does this episode do, you know, background wise, to serve up Juliet as someone we are continually interested in?
It's a great question, and it is one of the show's real achievements. And I should say, by the way, I should establish one more thing for the record here.
Yes,
I have begun a Lost rewatch.
Yay!
Inspired by you. And I'm currently 12 episodes into season one. So I'm yes. now having that experience where I'm talking about season three, episode seven, even though my own rewatch is halfway through season one of a show that I have previously watched more than once in full, which is completely disorienting and yet somehow feels perfect for the Lost experience. Yes. Like a meta text. I am at one with the characters who have no idea what's happening in time or space.
Fair.
But in a few weeks, I'll be ready to dive into to any specific that you can throw at me. Fear not. I used to have such an encyclopedic memory of every single aspect of Lost, and this is definitely one of those things that has made me feel like 100 years old. And I just am despondent that I guess I'm an old person now, and I don't have the memory that I did when I was young and vital. But such is life, so it goes. So to answer your question. Uh-huh. This is always a conundrum in storytelling, and I think for me personally, whether it is a show or a novel, anything where I'm spending a lot of time investing in the characters and in the universe that the creator has crafted, I have a tendency to be a little bit allergic to any change in circumstance, whether that is a new time period, a new set of characters, a new location, whatever it might be. Like, I think often of the first time I read The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And every time you move forward in the story and the exact orientation of where you were in the tale shifts around you, I would have this moment of, oh my God, I don't want this. I want to be where I just was. But then it's so good that after a few pages, you start to feel that way about that new place, that new moment in time.
That's how I feel about every season of The Wire, where I'm like, right. Why are we on the docks? I don't care about the docks. Why am I in the school? I don't care about the school. And then like three episodes in, I'm like, I would die for every character that's here. I never wanted any other way, sort of thing. But there's that resistance to change.
Yeah.
And then that adaptation, when done well, that adaptation to it.
Exactly. And so Lost is, you know, a part of that great tapestry, and especially because of the nature of season one of Lost and this idea that these characters don't know where they are. They don't know what is happening around them. And quite early, they come to understand that they are not alone. And so we, of course, as the viewer, also understand that. And it is like an ingrained expectation from the beginning that we're going to be meeting new people. And because so much of that is positioned as the unknown, it is by its very nature, like definitionally something I think you're a little bit opposed to. Are these people a threat? Are they a threat to the people that I have invested in, love, and want to protect? Even the ones who were introduced as nominal good guys, they're just taking airtime from the other people that you want to see at that point. So that's always going to be a delicate balance. And, you know, certainly like the example is like the pinnacle of Lost miscalculating viewers' desire to maybe invest in something that they hadn't already invested in, right? But broadly, for me, the Lost experience tended to be of a piece with that Cavalier and Clay reading experience I just described. That initial, why am I not just watching Sawyer read Watership Down on the beach, which I could do personally. I mean, personally, mileage may vary, uninterrupted on loop from now until the moment I die. But if the character is compelling, then I'm going to want to watch. And Juliet roped me in right away. And I think to actually 10 minutes later, answer your question. I think the reason that Not in Portland is such a strong episode and is such a strong and effective way of getting you to invest in Juliet is because it is simultaneously familiar and different, right? That's a delicate balancing act. The familiarity comes from seeing somebody who is clearly not at peace in their circumstance, which of course is also true for all of the people we've invested in by now. The moment when you realize that this is somebody who, after the iconic and Ethan recruitment plot, has made a choice. You know, the crash survivors of the Oceanic flight, initially at least, did not choose to be on the island. Right. Juliet, knowing, by the way, that she casually says this thing that she then is, you know, ashamed of and horrified by about her controlling ex-husband needing to be hit by a bus so that she could be free, sees that that then happens, clearly has the sense, even the way she looks at Ethan, oh, have we met? And of course, you know, we remember that they passed in the hall and, you know, can deduce that based on what they know about her sister's successful pregnancy that Ethan has been spying, you know, sleuthing.
Keeping tabs,
as he is wont to do. She knows that something is going on that is unusual and that is unsettling to her, and yet she still opts in. That is a fundamentally different circumstance from a lot of the other characters. And so I just find that instantly so interesting, and I want to know more about a person who would make that choice.
Right. Who would choose to fairly recently, it would seem, throw their lot in with these folks? Because, you know, we don't know a lot about the others at this point. We're knowing more and more every week, but now we know that, like, it's not, it might not just be that you're born on this island and so you're another, but you might get drafted into whatever the service is that they are doing here. You know, we had enough of a shock as season three opens and we find out that not only are the others on this island, but they're living in, like, suburbia on this island. That's the reveal of...
I love a cul-de-sac, you know? Love a cul-de-sac.
Love some ticky-tacky houses. So, so, you know, we find that out, and now we find out that... because I don't know if you've, in your Lost obsession, have, like, dug into some of the early documents, but they initially called the others the Jungle Creeps. That's, like, was their initial, the writer's initials, like, names for them.
Yeah.
And then I think over time they decided to make them a bit, you know, clearly more sophisticated, more what have you, beyond the Jungle Creeps creeping around.
I love an edit. As an editor, I love an edit. So I applaud and respect that choice.
What if instead they have a book club? What if that instead? Exactly. And Juliet's a big part of that. And so, yeah, no, I love that, what you have to say about choice there. It makes me think about, I mean, not to lean too heavily on our shared obsessive TV watching experience, but it makes me think about Game of Thrones, how, you know, there was a time in Game of Thrones when we thought they could do no wrong, especially when they did something as flawless as give us Oberyn Martell,
right,
and have so little time to get us so invested so that we're devastated by the time he leaves us. Mm-hmm. And so then we're like, oh, well, they absolutely, absolutely know what they're doing. And then to have them like flop the rest of Dorne so hard, you know, so soon thereafter. And so, you know, it just makes me think that you have to approach these things more thoughtfully, even if you've done it so successfully. Mm-hmm. You have to be very thoughtful about the way in which you introduce these new storylines that are taking us away from our favorites in some way or another, you know?
Yes, totally. And again, Juliet served two functions, and that's part of what allowed it to work so well. Again, I'm going to try really hard not to say something about the future here. How do you do this? This is so hard. Oh my God. I definitely am not disciplined enough to do this.
We could do, we will do a spoiler section and you can get it all out there. Okay. So, yeah.
But, you know, the fact that she is a new lens through which we can understand the others and the inner workings, as you just said a few minutes ago, of who these people are, how they got there, what they might be fighting for, what their motivation might be, and that it's probably not only not the same, but going to vary quite widely person to person, but also that she is not, and I mean, this is where it's fitting that you just mentioned the origin of the name, because this is where the name is so apt, you know, this idea of the others, this group that is definitionally separate and apart from our heroes, the characters that we have grown to love. She is also so clearly right away going to be a part of that story. You know, the chemistry that she has with the other actors, not in Portland, and the prior episodes in season three, you know, the nature of the interactions with Jack. I love the moment so much at the end of this episode, and I guess I can't say why, but whereas Sawyer and Kate are escaping with poor sweet Carl, darling, oh, Carl. And Kate is recounting the 5 second fear management story to Jack on the walkie-talkie, and Sawyer, the look on Sawyer's face as he's watching Kate cry, and the emotion, the depth of the bond that Kate and Jack have formed to that point is so apparent to everybody who's watching that, and to see Sawyer watching that, and then to see Juliet standing there, and to think about the way that all of these people are already connected, but how they will be connected in the future. And again, that question of how much of that is it preordained, determined by some guiding island hand, and how much of that is the product of their own making, the decisions that they make about who they want to be and what they want to be for each other. Like, I had forgotten how incredible that couple minutes is, and it's something that on a rewatch I think is incredibly rewarding, because so much just passes between them in a glance, and you know, as a viewer, you can just really appreciate history. And you know, one of the things that's fun about a show like Lost is history isn't linear. It exists in this massive sprawling web. You know, history looks like the Dharma Initiative sigil. It's just all of these different lines moving and connecting with each other, and Juliet is just so instantly and cleanly a part of that.
Something that helps us love her in this episode is she takes out the character of Pickett, who is like
great stuff.
I don't know how. Yeah, I don't know what your what your memory of this is, but like Danny Pickett is like one of the most obnoxious villains ever on Lost. Yeah. He's only here for like this. You know, they wrote the first 6 episodes of the season as sort of like a mini season, and they took a prolonged break,
right?
And this
like is a 13-week
return
break.
From that break. Yeah. And And Danny Pickett's like one of the main antagonists in that six episodes. And I'm just like, as a rewatcher, I'm just like, when is this guy leave? I'm really ready for him to go, because he's not like, I love a Lost villain.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. But like, I prefer my Lost villains like Ben to be sort of like really deeply rooted in something psychological not Danny, who's just like a rage monster. And I'm just uninterested in his like misdirected rage that's sort of spewing everywhere. And so for Juliet to just like knock him out, I'm like, thank you, bless you.
Yeah,
as you say, great stuff. It's
totally, and it's a great stuff. You love to see it, as the kids say. Is that how memes work? Yes. But you know, like you're saying, that moment is, it's also just a perfect microcosm of this Juliet contains multitudes idea, the nature of her disposition, and the contrast. Even inside of this episode, which is one of the things that makes the construction of it so effective, you know, you think to what's transpiring back in Miami, in the conversations with, in the flashback, you know, whatever you think I am, I'm not. This idea that she's conveying to him about how she's not a leader. This we see the way that, you know, the obvious brilliance and power that she is able to deploy in her research, the work that she's doing to help her sister Rachel, but also the effect that Edmund Burke shouts to Lost's proud tradition of naming characters after philosophers, and this sense of feeling trapped in her own life. And that's another thing, a painful thing that I love about Juliet's character, is the way the show so expertly can, again, subvert your expectations and invert your hopes. You know, she makes a choice to leave a situation like that, to take control over her own life, and then ends up a prisoner of a different sort, at least for a while. But to flash between her saying something like, whatever you think I am, I'm not, and then seeing the command that she takes in that moment, completely unafraid to make the choice to pull that trigger, obviously previously deciding to ask Jack to kill Ben. And, you know, very few things on Lost are ever clean. That's part of what's interesting about it. There are real ramifications and real stakes when the characters do dangerous, risky things. It very rarely works out totally in their favor. But she is so determined to take action, so determined to try to regain her own agency and her own control over her life. And it's just such an effective adjacency in this episode.
Yeah, and especially in contrast to we should think about our castaways in that regard as well, then. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you think of that, the early, you know, you're in season one right now, in your rewatch. There's a lot about the, like, the cave versus the beach.
Yes.
Dynamic. And it's like, do we hunker down, or do we continually, like, strive for escape? What do we do?
Yes.
Do
we live in the caves that just collapsed on Jack and Charlie just because Michael looked at a load-bearing bit of rock and said it was fine? Do we do that?
Should we try that? Or later in season one, you know, do we hop on a raft? Do we stay? Yes. What do we do? You know, that sort of like push and pull, the different kind of personality, like what kind of personality makes the society and stuff like that. And this idea that like Juliet is in a, you know, when we meet her, and her introduction in the first episode of the season is one of my all-time favorites. Like, Desmond's right up there too, right at the beginning of season two, and then they intentionally mirrored it at the beginning of season three. You see Juliet getting ready for book club, and she's like, we meet her, she's like crying, trying to pull herself together, and like puts on some Petula Clark downtown and like is baking and getting ready for a book club, and you're like, who are you and why are you stressed,
right?
And why are you putting on a smile, and what's happening here?
Yes.
And I want to know more. And so to think of her as someone who is continually trying to regain agency over her situation, I think is a really useful way to frame that character.
Yes, for sure.
You're great. You're great, Mallory. I'm so glad you're here to talk to me about Juliet and Lost. Are there other aspects of this specific episode that you want to dig into?
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. I mean, an amazing Easter egg episode, though. I'm sure you guys have already discussed that at length. In terms of Juliet specifically, I'm trying to think of if there's anything else I can say that wouldn't be a future spoiler. I do like the contrast, but also the camaraderie that is so quickly established between Juliet and Jack. This fundamental aspect of her character, I think, is she sees people really clearly. Really clearly. Sometimes better than they see themselves. That is, of course, at the heart of the eventual. The moment when she's just like calls Jack out, "You're not gonna let him die? I know you won't," is just perfect, because it tells you so much about both of those people. And she's so insightful, so unafraid, you know, and this will end up leading to obviously some interesting conflict with Kate and some of the other characters, but so unafraid to say, "I know who you are, and I know this other person better than you do." And I think this episode, especially given that it's her episode to own, the episode that is clearly designed to signal to the audience, this is a person that you're going to be spending a lot more time with, and you need to embrace that fully. A little thing like that, and there are just so many little things like that in this episode, I just love.
Love it. And the thing is, anytime that Juliet reads a character, I'm like, she's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Juliet is always right. It's almost, Saeed is similar in terms of like, Saeed is, there's only, I think, like twice, I've rewatched the show a couple times recently, and I think there's only twice, maybe three times, that Saeed like gets a situation wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Usually if Saeed says someone's lying, they're lying. So
right.
That's a nice barometer to have. And Juliet, usually if Juliet has read your character and made a decision, she knows. She's done it. She's
well, done her homework. And also to your earlier point, though, about the nature of the midway introduction, like that builds trust with the audience, right? It makes it so much easier to say this person knows what they're talking about, and I am ready to take them seriously, because the thing that she is saying about Jack is something I know to be true. And the fact that she can recognize that allows me to open up. And I think just in general, the character and the portrayal, it's just so, there's something so warm and welcoming
yeah.
about Juliet. Mm-hmm. Like you want to be in that book club. I want to be in that book club. And you know, my feelings on Carrie are probably slightly closer to Ben's than Juliet's, but you know, I'd love a burnt baked good, and I'd love to gather with friends and talk about a story that I love. So I'd love to spend more time with Juliet, or at least talking about Juliet. It's just a delight to reminisce here with you,
Mallory Rubin. if folks want to hear more of you and your very, very incisive breakdown of story and character, where can they find you?
Check out Binge Mode on the Ringer Podcast Network. Jason Concepcion and I host that podcast. We have gone quite deep on Game of Thrones, Harry Potter, Star Wars. We are going to be starting another deep dive soon. So keep your eyes peeled for that announcement.
Watch that spot. Ooh, can't wait. All right. And then can folks find you on Twitter somewhere?
Oh, my God. They can. What's my Twitter handle? I think it's just my name, at Mallory Rubin. There it is. And hey, same handle on Instagram, where, as Joanna knows, I exclusively post pictures of my cat.
All right, now is time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. They hang out with us. They watch movies with us. They get bonus episodes. They're great. We got some newcomers this week. I want to thank Sharon Deegan, Marky Idea, Robin Meyer, Deborah Ackerman, Florence, Rick Russell, Renee, Nathan Mellahan, Jennifer Mahari, Jenny V, Catherine Huey, Justin, Time Traveler Creative, Rosemary, Christina Rudy, TLS, Benjamin, Krikebomber, Shauna Evans, and Sandra.
And I would like to add to that thanks, Ben Miller, Casey Schonbrun,
so pretty.
Amber Plotch, Jennifer Holloway, Daniel Keeling, S.M., Eric Stratton, Christopher Schnazy, Rona, Raquel, Asvedo McKenney, Jessica Caposi, Liz Beauregard, Kyle Clark, Sydney, Aaron, Kate Whitney, Cassandra Sabo, Corinne, Miranda Lane, Abby Bateman, and Abby Bateman.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Victoria Yoder, Carolyn, Rajiv Dasani, Lori Bonar, Pekka Koskimaki, okay, maybe, Shannon Black, Isabel Hazel Roundtree Jones, Tiffany Flowers, Charles Camacho, Charlotte Daly, Sean Ambrolt, Dan Allen, Susan Flanagan, Christina Brosius, Rachel Fisher Bramble, Monty Cross, Susan Kustush, Danielle Shepherd, Spencer Howard, and Susan P. Thank you all very much for being small council members. You rule.
And we're back for the storm, the time storm. Sorry,
Jared. No, it's okay. Should we start with our storm discussion with Mallory Rubin?
Oh, yes, yes. Did we not transition to that in the middle of the... I guess we should start with that for sure. So you've heard the sounds. You're in the storm. If you're here by accident, sorry, but back to Mallory.
Can we do 5 minutes of spoiler talk?
Yeah.
I can't help myself. Yep. Are you sure?
So here we go.
It's still to me the most painful death in Lost history. It's just devastating. Devastating. I cried today just thinking about it. And it is the combination of, again, I am mostly responding just emotionally to how much I care about Juliet and how much I care about Juliet and Sawyer. I guess I should say James at that point. But also, I do think it is some of the best work that the show ever did in terms of navigating that very, very, very delicate, sometimes ultimately too delicate, balance between mythology and character. The incident, it's this massive moment, this massive thing that unlocks so much about the wider mythology of the show. And of course, like, I care about that as it's unfolding. It's this essential elemental lost information download. But I'm just, like, so sad, right? So sad watching it. And one of the things I really loved about rewatching that in Portland is just, like, you know, a little moment like the Apollo ad on the side of the bus, and then thinking, of course, about the Apollo candy bar at the vending machine when Sawyer and Juliet find each other again and awaken. You know, she's just great. And she and Sawyer are, I think, a top five all-time TV couple for me. They really are.
I think you said, I don't know what you said that on recently, but you said it on some show that you were doing recently, and one of our, like, a couple of our mutual listeners who, like, they're like, you don't have to feel bad about this, but they're like, oh, now I know that Sawyer and Juliet get together because Mallory Rubin said they were, like, a top couple. And I was like, well, you know, yeah, what? It's been a decade.
Yeah,
it's
my general policy on this is that I try really hard for the night a show aired to not say what happened on it, and after a decade,
and then after that,
I sort of start to let myself off the hook. But I am sorry to you, to the listener who I spoiled that for. But even just earlier in the 20 or 30 or so prior minutes of conversation, I wasn't sure how much I could say about Sawyer and how much known or understood.
You did a great job, I thought. Whew. I thought you did a great job. It's funny because we interviewed a bunch of people recently about the Lost finale and its legacy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the question I started with for everyone was, like, what's the number one thing you remember? And almost every single person was like, Sawyer and Juliet at the vending machine. That's the moment of the finale, honestly. And then if you know, you talked about crying, which I cry when she dies, then they redo her death at the beginning of the next season.
Brutal.
Right? And then there's a scene several episodes after that where Sawyer is talking to Kate like about how he was going to propose to Juliet and how he let her down.
Absolutely agonizing.
I weep at that.
Just agonizing.
And then I weep when they meet each other at the vending machine, and I'm just sort of like, yeah, Sawyer and Juliet. Like, honestly, I like Desmond and Penny get all the like love, but there's not, that's Desmond and Penny is like a great episode, but Sawyer and Juliet is just like a great arc. It's so good.
Yeah. And again, like, oh man, everything you just said, now I'm getting emotional just hearing you speak. But you know, the repeated lines, these connections, these parallels, you know, we should get coffee sometimes, we can go Dutch, James, kiss me, you got it, Blondie. And you know, knowing when you're watching that, when you're watching that at the vending machine, thinking back to the absolute despair of watching her die in his arms. I'm glad you mentioned the Sawyer Kate scene on the beach, because, you know, tender, vulnerable Sawyer is one of my favorite things in the history of television. So it's beautiful to me just for that. But much like that walkie-talkie scene in Not in Portland that we were discussing earlier, I just love these moments where these relationships connect back to each other. And of course, when you think about Juliet's death, not the actual, after they dig her up and she dies in Sawyer's arms, but when she falls down the shaft in the first place before she activates the bomb, it doesn't actually matter knowing how everything is going to end. Like, it is just heart-wrenching to go back and watch the conversation between Juliet and Sawyer, where she basically says to him, I saw the way you looked at her, you know?
Yeah.
And that to me is just like the most human and relatable thing on the show. It's like everybody has felt that way at some point in life, right? And that's a really, really, really bad feeling, but that's also part of what it is to be a person in the world. And I always thought that their relationship allowed us to think about these characters as human beings as well as maybe any other relationship on the show. And hearing Sawyer talk to Kate about Juliet, like, there's a version of this show, if Lost is legions of other TV shows, where Jack and Juliet are the ones who are definitely supposed to be together. They're the soulmates, and Kate and Sawyer are. And I just love that that's not how this went. You know, the surprising nature of finding a connection with somebody, a transformative connection with somebody who you maybe never would have thought wanted to be with you, and it's more about wanting to be with you than you wanting to be with them. I just love that so much. And
it obviously like feeds right into our like Jamie Lannister, Brienne of Tarth, like Cersei thing, where it's like
very on brand for
we were us. Talking about we were talking about love triangles last week, but this idea that like, and it initially started this way with Kate, and then they sort of just like lost the ball in it. But like initially with Sawyer and Jack and Kate, it was supposed to be Kate torn between, you know, the woman she had been, which seems like it matches with Sawyer, versus the woman she'd like to be, which seems like it matches with Jack. Mm-hmm. Right. And that was sort of something that the show was going for. That was the thing that was like tearing her apart. And then it just like, the show like kind of loses Kate, honestly, right around here, I would say. But that triangle sort of gets redone with Kate and Sawyer and Juliet, where Sawyer is sort of torn between the guy that he has been and the guy, you know, the LaFleur, like the guy that he can be, you know, and in a healthy partnership that reinforces like the most, you know, the healthiest choices he can make for himself. And that's why LaFleur is a top episode for me.
So good.
And all the lead up with Julie, like the whole, like, you still got my back, you still got mine. Mm-hmm. Like all of that stuff between them is so, so strong that, I think it's the strongest love story on the island. And I will make it my mission to convince every single person listening to agree with us by the end of this rewatch project.
I'm delighted to hear it. You have my full support.
Is there any other spoilery stuff you want to say before you let you go?
I think that was it. I had to sob about the death and gush about their love, their beautiful love story for just a moment.
Thank you for indulging me. Thank you for coming. I to have made Mallory cry, not made, but, you know, been in the presence of Mallory crying over story is truly the best anyone could hope for on a Tuesday afternoon. All right, Mallory, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was a delight.
I will have you back when you're caught up and you let me know what else you want to talk about.
Oh, my God.
I can pencil you in for LaFleur right now if you want to.
It's a date. You
know. All right.
We can go Dutch.
Oh, beautiful.
And now we're back to the storm. Storm.
Storm. Time. Time. Time.
Time.
Time.
So,
time.
In the official podcast, they mention actually two anagrams. I only brought up the other one because they brought it up on the podcast, and it seems like they wanted to start teasing time. They're back after the break in the middle of season three, so they obviously know what their big conclusion is, and I assume the lost time is the season four they're going to fill out that they're referring to. But the second anagram, Lostopedia has an idea of what it was. I don't know how much I buy this. Here, I'm going to tell you guys. You figure it
out. It's bananas.
The backwards speech found in Room 23 video, only fools are enslaved by time and space. This is an anagram for bones of lost Nadlers may lay deep in a cave, or bones of Nadlers may lay deep in a lost cave. An inner anagram of Nadlers is Landers, i.e. people of the land, thus related to Adam and Eve, whose bones are in a cave.
But Nadler is also Rosa Bernard's last name, right?
That's true.
Wow.
I bet at some point they had the idea of making Rose and Bernard Adam and Eve. What do you bet?
Before,
that would make sense.
Because the real Adam and Eve is
the mother and the man in black.
Okay. Yeah.
I bet they were gonna make it Rose and Bernard because we know that Rose and Bernard hung out on the island for a really long time, just chilling. So, you know.
So I wasn't able to find anything from last week. I'm not done with my search about when did they know for sure they were ending it. But it feels like at this point, if that anagram is correct and not a really weird mistake, that means they know where they're ending it. They know they're going all the way through time travel. They're going through season five, and they have some vague ideas of season six, I would assume. But also, they can't have all season six planned because that makes some of the beginning of season six make less sense. But yeah, bones of the Nadlers lie deep in a lost cave. That's a really deeply hidden anagram, almost unbelievable.
Like I said, people really went deep on this Room 23 thing, and it was too much for me at the time, and probably still too much.
Bones of Nadler's melee deep in Lost Cave. I feel like there should be a really cool 70s drug jam about Bones of Nadler's. Yeah,
by Geronimo Jackson.
Maybe Geronimo Jackson, but I was actually thinking of Donovan, who did that song Atlantis, right? Very Atlantis-y.
But then it turns out Room 23 means nothing. It's used to cause a brief short-term memory loss, which is revealed in the special features of the series after season six. So not everything has an answer when it's thrown into the story at this point, as we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we've got a couple emails that I want to hit, if that's cool with y'all. This one comes from Melissa. I don't know that we have the answer to this, but I'm hoping by reading it, someone else may give us the answer. I tried tweeting, but maybe it went unseen. But why did the writers never tell us how or why Kate was in Australia besides running away? Part of her coming clean to her cop husband is that she realizes she can't go on their honeymoon without a valid passport. I've tried combing through sources and nothing. So I thought I'd ask the experts. Melissa. So do you have any thoughts about why or how Kate got to Australia.
Yeah, this is really one of the all-timers, isn't it?
What's the Kate Austin timeline?
That's what I'm trying to think about.
Does she take the airplane to Australia?
Hold on.
Yes, because she already gets the airplane out at that point. All about Kate Middleton's Australian tour. Thanks, Google.
Well, I'm looking through her like the timeline, the prior to the crash timeline, but it doesn't have the Cassie stuff in there. So I don't know when the Cassie stuff happens. Right, where she and Cassie are like,
yeah, it sort of jumps from
con gal pals, but it's like her breaking out the airplane from the bank vault.
And then she fled to
Australia, where while sleeping in a barn, she was discovered by a farmer. So,
yeah.
So it's right after the plane.
Oh, cool. So we just get to make it up then. What do we think Kate was doing?
Well,
that led her to Australia.
Running. But I since Cassie's not on here, I'm going to say Cassie gave her, I don't remember how the Cassie episode ends, if I'm being honest with you, but like maybe Cassie helped her get the passport to go, the fake passport.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking Cassidy probably helped her out. I don't know why Australia necessarily, but maybe she just took off. You know, I know people. I had a cousin or have a cousin who just, you know, took off across the.
I had a cousin and she took off.
No, across Asia, just as like a backpack thing. It's a weird thing that people do. So this is like Kate's version of backpacking. Maybe she was headed for. Where they filmed Lord of the Rings, and she just got caught up in Australia.
Oh, I guess the Cassidy stuff was the Cassidy stuff. And I apologize if I said Cassie earlier. I apologize, Cassidy. The Cassidy stuff, I guess, happens before the hospital because Kate's mom is still like healthy and like waitressing and not in the hospital, like dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes Cassidy, then the hospital, then R.I.P. Tom, then
Kevin.
Nathan Fillion, then bank vault robbery, then Australian farm.
Things really go off the rails after she doesn't marry Kevin. She starts doing the banks.
Well, she marries him, but then she...
Or after she, yeah, she bails on Kevin.
Yeah. Ooh, she was planning to subsequently travel to Bali. But
maybe she was supposed to also go to Thailand.
To get a
tattoo with Jack.
All right. So the answer is like, we don't seem to know. And maybe someone listening knows better than we do, but yeah.
And maybe that's the spinoff show. What happened to Kate?
Well, I think Lost 2 has to answer that question. I don't know. See, that's the problem with Lost 2 though. The second Evangeline Lilly shows up, you're like, wait, is this Lost 2? And then you've blown the whole premise of Lost 2.
Sure.
Lost 2, what Kate did later.
Right.
More
thing Kate did. All right. So then the other thing that we're going to do here in the storm today is we got an email requesting that we sort of sort the lost characters into a D&D alignment chart. Someone emailed us saying like they couldn't find a good one and they would like us to do it maybe. This is from Jason. He says, I did a Google search. We couldn't find anything. I'm not a huge D&D person. My friend is, and also a Lost fan. I think he would find it really interesting. Also going to keep trying to get him to listen to the cast. So maybe we can get Jason's friend to listen to the podcast if we sort the characters with the D&D alignment chart. All right. So I found a D&D alignment chart with Lost characters that I sent to the guys before we started recording. We had the length of the podcast to figure out our own sortings. But I will start by reading out the chart that we did find. So you might have seen this 12 alignment, even if you don't play D&D, you might have seen this alignment thing. It's nine slots.
Mm-hmm.
Lawful good, neutral good, chaotic good, lawful neutral, true neutral, chaotic neutral, lawful evil, neutral evil, chaotic evil, right? Those are the nine things. So the one that I randomly found on a Pinterest board has Jack is lawful good, Hurley is neutral good, Sawyer as chaotic good. Saeed is lawful neutral. Jacob as true neutral, which made both Neil and me laugh. Ben is chaotic neutral. Charles Widmore is lawful evil. The man in black is neutral evil. And Kimi as chaotic evil. So I have some agreements and disagreements with this, and I'm happy to read a larger definition of any of the categories if you guys want that.
I actually, this chart that we have makes me want to all exclusively do it with the women characters.
I know. I tried to do that, but there weren't enough.
Oh, damn it, Lost.
What? Surely there has to be 9 female characters.
Okay, so. Okay. I mean, well, there are.
But are they all different?
Can we put them on the thing?
Okay, I mean, because so. the issue with this thing is it's like 80% white dudes.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we can plug a couple of them in here. Juliet, she's probably.
I have her on my chart.
Neutral good?
I have her on lawful neutral.
Okay, so she's in there.
Neutral good is a neutral good character typically acts altruistically without regard or against lawful precepts such as rules or tradition. A neutral good character has no problems with cooperating with lawful officials but does not feel beholden to them.
So like Rose would be neutral good.
Lawful neutral is a lawful neutral character typically believes strongly in lawful concepts such as honor, order, rules, and tradition, but often follows a personal code in addition to or even in preference to one set down by a benevolent authority. And that's what I like about Juliet, is that I feel like she's like, and Mallory talked about this a lot in our conversation, where she's just sort of, she makes internal compass decisions a lot. Mm-hmm. In deciding what she's going to do next. So that's my interpretation.
Throw Libby in true neutral.
Libby.
Instead of Jacob? Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Right. Jacob, at least, that's the same thing I have with having Man in Black as neutral evil and Widmore as lawful evil. I feel like those would switch because the Man in Black is all about the fucking rules.
I like Widmore as lawful evil because this is one of the definitions I've read of lawful evil, which is a lawful evil character sees a well-ordered system as being easier to exploit than to necessarily follow. And I just feel like Widmore is such a good example. Charles Widmore is such a good example of someone who is like playing the game of business. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like to his own benefit. He knows how to manipulate the systems perfectly to his advantage. I guess you could say that about Smokey too. I put Smokey in chaotic evil, but because the chaotic evil tends to have no respect for rules, other people's lives, or anything but their own desires, which are typically selfish and cruel.
I mean, I think Kimi's really good there because, like I said, Man in Black is obsessed with the rules. Like, the rules are all his thing. Like, he needs to find the loophole, the rule to the thing, and then he could get off the island.
Yeah, that's not a bad point. My favorite casting, really quickly, I'm going to do mine, and then I'm going to... This is the last one that I like really care about, which is Kate as chaotic neutral, because a chaotic neutral character is an individualist who follows their own hearts and generally shirks rules and traditions. Although chaotic neutral characters promote ideals of freedom, it is their own freedom that comes first. Good and evil come second to their need to be free.
Mm. I would say either Kate or Rousseau fits there.
Sure.
Rousseau. There's a couple that I still wear. Like, where would Sun go on this?
That's a tough one.
This is me learning about these alignments.
Sun's a tough one.
Sun's a tough one. Penny is what, neutral good?
Well, wait, what version of Sun? Like the ultimate version of Sun?
Just like Sun.
The ultimate version of Sun's on the bottom. She's an evil character.
Yeah.
She's like a lawful evil or a neutral evil.
Well, the thing is, like, when Sun gets off the island and like she thinks Jin is dead, she is like, fuck everyone. I will burn your village down.
It's some chaotic evil energy.
But then she's like, I don't know. Like, I actually almost wish they had made Sun go like sort of full villain, because they kind of pull back from that. And then she goes back to the island and then she like dies. It's hard. I feel like there's 3 different Suns, if I'm being honest with you. So.
We call that an alignment switch, and I severely punish my D&D members if they do that. We're like, oh no, I'm gonna kill him. I'm like, you would not kill him. And they're like, no, I think I would. I'm like, if you are gonna switch your alignment, you're gonna take fucking penalty. Anyway, Sun could take a penalty.
Here's one. Here's a good one. Where would we put Frank Lupitas on this? Frank the pilot.
You don't have to tell me.
No, I know. We all know who Lupitas is.
Lawful neutral?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He comes around, but he doesn't come around until he's stranded on the island.
He's
with everybody,
lawful, though. So. He's not more of like a chaotic neutral?
I don't think he's chaotic.
No.
I think he's pretty. Might be neutral good eventually.
Oh, he could be chaotic good.
Sort of in the Sawyer category.
Well, just like he doesn't.
Good.
He doesn't really know what he's doing until he has to take off the plane at the end. Otherwise, he's just sort of like always on to the next step and trying to be okay with himself. I feel like he could be chaotic good.
There you go.
Accidentally ends up being the bad guy sometimes just because he's.
I'm trying to find like a neutral good from another character other than Hurley. That one's a tougher one. Penny, no, Penny's maybe not neutral. Penelope Widmore?
Maybe. I'm trying to think about where I put Faraday. Because here's the thing. Faraday knows that it all happens, except that his mom shoots him.
And he's going along with it anyway.
Yeah, because he kind
of
can't.
So is that more
of
a chaotic neutral energy, where it's like, I'm embracing the chaos, but I'm not really, I'm just sort of going with it?
I mean, it's weird because it's super lawful by, I think, the terms of an alignment chart. But also, that negates the question of if anything's good by the nature of how Lost treats time travel. So he's lawful Daniel.
He's lawful outside of time and space.
Yeah, lawful outside of time and space. but otherwise, I don't like. It's hard to say. Are his intentions good, neutral, or bad? I mean, I guess
here's
good.
Here's the real kicker. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do we put John Locke?
Well, even the Wikipedia I'm now noticing has two different versions of John Locke under character list. I just went to look at like the character page. Because there's, you know, there's John Locke, and then there's Man in Black, John Locke. John Flock, as I believe some have called him. Where do you put John Locke on this one?
I put him at chaotic good.
Yeah. Or maybe, well, okay, what's the difference between chaotic good and chaotic neutral?
I'm going to push back against the person last week who said that John Locke was a Trump voter. I've decided, I've been thinking about this a lot.
Okay.
And I've decided that John Locke is a fucking libertarian, but not like the bad libertarian.
He's like a social, true libertarian. There are like socialist libertarians who believe in, they're more like local community type of people.
Yeah.
John Locke would be, because he lived on a commune, so.
I don't think he would vote for.
Oh, shit. Okay. While Googling definitions, one came up that answered our Locke question for us. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Chaotic good. A chaotic good character acts as his conscience directs him with little regard for what others expect for him. He believes in goodness and right, but has little use for laws and regulations. He hates it when people try to intimidate others and tell them what to do.
I said chaotic good. So
I know.
What this exercise has revealed is that you and I think Locke think the same thing about Locke, and so
I don't know if I subscribe to it. I just googled something, and it's like, doesn't like it when people tell him what to do, and I'm like, well, that has to be our answer for Locke.
There it is. Chaotic good. We all agree. So next time you ask me if John Locke is the antagonist, I'm gonna say no, he's chaotic good.
Oh pff. No, good antagonists can be chaotic good. Just like an alignment and antagonist protagonist are completely different things.
I, for one, am just glad that this is settled.
I'm the one who's been doing game mastering, and with all respect, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
getting all worked up over D&D.
So huffy.
On the Lost podcast. look at what it's done to us. All right. Did we get all our emails in?
I think we did it.
We did it. Nice. We did some alignment things. Please, by all means, if you have thoughts on alignments, we would appreciate that. The host at stormpodcast.com. Until then, Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, something happens when you die, Dave. And it's that some things flash before your eyes, which is what's going to happen next week. Wow, yeah, sorry. Terrible windup there. Flashes Before Your Eyes is the next episode. It is a Desmond episode, and that's always good news. So there you go.
Hell yes. Until then, where can people find more of your work online? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. That's about it. Oh, no, I'm doing a podcast called Truth Versus Hollywood. We just finished up Goodfellas. This week we're starting Social Network. So Dave Chen and I break down the true story behind a film that you've probably seen based on a true story. We tell you what the real true story is. And we've got interviews with folks who would know because they were there. So nice. Truth Versus Hollywood. Check it out.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, on Twitter, at rejects, at one perfect shot. And if you are a member of our Patreon and you are in our Slack every single day for the next, most of the next month, we are watching Avatar, The Last Airbender, 2 episodes a day, 3 o'clock central. Be there. It's awesome. It's been fun.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me in the Fighting in the War Room podcast. That's just wherever you find podcasts. And here, every week, reminding you to not fall down.